Hey, everybody. Apologies. The file that went out early this morning did not have Peter Suderman's track in it. Just a editing screw up on our end. But this is the full file. So if this is in your feed twice, I apologize. April Fools, I guess. No, it's just a screw up. But this is the full episode. You should really listen because Peter makes a lot of good points about FCC Chair Brendan Carr and how bad he is. So listen and apologies again. Welcome back to this Tuesday's Across the Movie Aisle, presented by Bulwark Plus. I'm your host, Sonny Bunch, culture editor of The Bulwark. I'm joined, as always, by the award-winning Alyssa Rosenberg of The Washington Post and Peter Suderman of Reason Magazine. Alyssa, Peter, how are you today?
I'm spiffy.
I am so happy to be talking about movies with friends.
First up, in controversies and non-troversies, Donald Trump's Federal Communications Commission chair, Brendan Carr, urged the organization's enforcement arm to open up an investigation into whether or not Disney and ABC are engaging in, quote, invidious, end quote, DEI efforts that run afoul of the commission's rules against discrimination. Now, Disney has already said that it is ending or amending a number of their diversity, equity, and inclusion initiatives. But this is not enough for Carr. In a letter to Disney chief Bob Iger, he wrote, quote, although your company recently made some changes to how it brands certain efforts, it is not clear that the underlying policies have changed in a fundamental manner, nor that past practices complied with relevant FCC regulations, end quote. Among the highlighted transgressions are the creation of, quote, affinity groups, end quote, and the mandating of quotas in products that required at least 50% of characters and staff on shoots come from quote-unquote marginalized groups. And this is one of those stories where, like, it's theoretically possible to make good faith case here that the FCC is, in fact, trying to uphold the law, right? Quotas not allowed, can't do the quotas, discriminating against potential employees on the basis of race, even in an effort to increase some numerical ideal of racial diversity. It's wrong. Hot take. People should be neither hired nor fired thanks to the color of their skin. However, it's impossible to argue that the Trump administration's FCC chair is doing this in good faith, because the Trump administration has made a habit of going after opponents, real and perceived, with the power of government. Like, who can forget that the FCC, for instance, went after Paramount Global, which is in the midst of an already tricky merger with Skydance, itself a thing that's under FCC review, because Trump and his team were convinced that CBS did something shady with Kamala Harris's interview during the presidential campaign. What did they do? I don't know. No one really seems to know what the accusations of editing in a way that we're going to harm Donald Trump and favor Kamala Harris were all about. It was bizarre.
They edited it, right? That was the accusation.
Yeah, I understand the accusation. I'm saying I don't understand how that would impact things one way or the other. Spoiler, interviews are edited all the time. Again,
editing is nefarious.
Bizarre moment in American politics, and the idea that a broadcast network can be held to account for how it edited an interview because the interview didn't make the president's campaign opponent look bad is insane. That's an insane thing. To quote a recent president, who I think we're all coming to appreciate just a little bit more, that was some weird shit. Peter, what is the deal with this variety of weird shit?
So look, Donald Trump started his second term by signing an order declaring that he was like bringing back free speech, that there would be no more censorship, that like he was the free speech president. And a lot of the people who supported Donald Trump, in particular, a lot of the people who came to support Donald Trump sort of later, right, like relatively late in the game, right, people who kind of flipped, were maybe skeptical of Donald Trump the first time around, were people who were like, you know what, cancel culture is bad and free speech is good. And that's why we want Donald Trump, because Joe Biden, Kamala Harris, the Democrats, that's the cancel culture party. There's some truth to that. Democrats were much more sort of on board the cancel culture train than Republicans were. And Donald Trump keeps saying things that, like, if you take them totally at face value as statements of deep and meaningful principles that, like, guide your behavior, are pretty pro-free speech. And then he keeps doing things that are totally antithetical to this. And in particular, appointing Brendan Carr to the FCC. So Brendan Carr is supposedly like a free speech warrior. I think that's a phrase that has been used here for him. And so much of what he has done in his brief time in office is basically go after media organizations for political reasons. This is that. This is the same thing happening again. And it's just ridiculous. He went after NewsGuard, for example. He's not the only Republican to go after NewsGuard, but he went after NewsGuard, which is this news rating source that's like, here, we're going to give news organizations, media organizations, independent ratings for their reliability, accuracy, that sort of thing, right? And basic facts about how NewsGuard runs their business, totally wrong, completely mistook this. But also, even if NewsGuard is doing stupid stuff, even if NewsGuard is doing stuff that I totally disagree with, like, they're an independent organization that is relying on free speech protections to say, we think that this organization is more accurate or this organization is less accurate, and we're going to give these people 5 stars and we're going to give these people 1 star or whatever their ranking is. It's not actually stars, right? But this is just a consistent thing that you see with Donald Trump, where he and his people say, we are totally pro-free speech. And they say a bunch of the right words in the right order, and then they don't turn out to be statements of principle at all, because anytime it comes down to discussion of Donald Trump, discussion of stuff that Donald Trump cares about, discussion of things like DEI, right? You see that they are trying to suppress private organizations and individuals from engaging in protected speech and in protected expression.
To a certain extent, both of you, don't you think part of the problem is that there is not actually sort of a broad-based coalition in support of a broad understanding of free speech in the country right now, right? I mean, you know, Peter, you talk about sort of liberals being more on board with cancel culture, but I think as liberals have justly pointed out, you have had a lot of Republican politicians who have brought extremely, you know, sort of heavy tools of the state to bear to suppress, you know, kids' access to various kinds of books, right? I mean, you know,
Though I would say that I don't think that that specific thing falls under the rubric of cancel culture, and where Republicans are worse, it's more just sort of like a kind of quasi-censorship rather than cancel culture.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I think that, you know, sort of cancel culture is sort of an aspect of our free speech debates, right? Like, it's not actually fully constitutive of a conversation about whether there is sort of the ability to have a wide-ranging public conversation about a lot of issues, but also, you know, whether people have consistent access to different kinds of material, you know, whether you can be deported for writing an op-ed in a tough student newspaper. I mean, you know, free speech includes a lot of different kinds of speech. It includes a lot of different kinds of access to information. It includes the ability to resist both, you know, sort of social pressures against or disfavoring certain kinds of speech, but also the ability to be free from government intervention. And there is not actually a big, broad American public consensus in favor of the idea that speech should be pretty freewheeling and wide open, right? I mean, you know, Greg Lukianoff, who runs FIRE and does a lot of really good free speech work across the aisle, has actually sort of had to say, like, yeah, actually, we defend all of these different kinds of speech in part because, you know, free speech has become practically a meaningless term in American politics. And sort of, we would need to have a kind of a common definition of what it is again in order to have a sort of rational conversation about who constitutes a free speech warrior or not.
Yeah, there's this really ironic thing happening in which the Trump administration and its supporters are reacting against what they perceived as a culture war against them by saying, we want to end the culture war against us. But then what they're doing is reenact, like, just reversing it, just taking the culture war back to the other side. It's not quite literally an inverse or a negative image of what, you know, of the thing they are reacting against, but it's surprisingly close. And it really does seem like a lot of the folks who are sort of claiming to be, you know, free speech types on the Trump side are, they don't actually value free speech, and they don't understand what the First Amendment is for. And they don't understand that, like, I mean, the very specific first thing, like the two things that people like just overlook about the First Amendment in particular, and the way the First Amendment protects free speech, is, first of all, the most important thing that the First Amendment protects is the ability to criticize the government almost in an unlimited way. I mean, literally, unless your criticism amounts to a physical, like an imminent threat of physical harm, basically any criticism of the government, even if it has no merit, even if it's based on kind of nonsense, basically any criticism of the government is fine, like under the is protected. That's protected speech. And it has to be, because the whole point.
Anything that's mean and unfair to Mr. Trump is not free speech, Peter.
Oh, I mean, I'm sorry. Thank you, Alyssa, for I misunderstood. You're right. No,
this is the real point here and the real problem, right, is that I know a lot of these people Peter is talking about who, you know, kind of reluctantly came to Donald Trump, said, well, you know, we've got to end this, you know, cancel culture thing. We got to end this, you know, demonization of speech. You know, people need to be free. And I'm sorry, there is nobody in the government who believes in free speech less than Donald Trump. Like he has made a case repeatedly in the course of his campaigns and as president that the most important thing is to punish the people who are mean to him and who say bad things about him and who oppose him in ways that he does not approve of. And he has made it very clear that he is willing to use the power of the government to do so. And this is the real issue here with the FCC. Again, let's bring it back to the FCC. The real danger here goes beyond general fuzzy principles about, well, freedom of speech, what are the limits on, you know, do we want to allow people to say whatever? Like, this goes beyond that, and is very specifically a First Amendment thing. The government using the powers that they have to punish organizations for speech that the president does not like, even if it is gussied up in this, well, they're actually going after discrimination. It's about the DEI discrimination. That's what they're doing here, is insane and wrong and has to stop. People have to speak out about it in a uniform and principled way that I have frankly only seen from FIRE, the Foundation for Individual Rights and Education, or whatever their new acronym is.
I will defend my organization. Reason Magazine and the Reason Foundation has been pretty consistent.
Sure, Reason. All right, whatever. Reason too. Okay.
We are quite aligned with our friends at FIRE.
Blanket disclaimer: you're one of the good ones. But no, I mean, but also part of what has to happen here is some of these media companies have to not settle, right? I mean, they have to see through this, you know, just obviously bogus, vindictive litigation that's been brought against them instead of folding. Because that's part of how you get the precedence. You need to impose some costs on the people who are doing this sort of thing. Like, the FCC needs to lose in court some. Trump needs to lose in court some. But when everybody folds, it, you know, it lends the perception that there's merit to some of these insane claims. And, you know, I think the unwillingness of any institution to fight, just even on its own behalf, not even in defense of the larger principles in a broad way, but the lack of willingness to sort of, you know, win the war where it started, as opposed to letting, you know, there be a bunch of incursions into territory. And I'm going to stop torturing this metaphor because it's bad, but
torture is always bad.
Yes, torture is always bad, even in metaphors.
Sonny's like, I don't know.
That's a different debate. We can have that debate at some other point.
Speaking of George W. Bush.
Always coming around full circle. But no, I think that, there needs to be some sort of corporate self-defense here, because I think if we all think back to sort of the FCC of our youth, right, it was like, those debates about decency feel sort of laughable now, right? Like, you know, Eminem was absolutely correct that, like, the FCC was not ultimately going to have a lot of power over him because he was too popular, right? Like, decency violations weren't really going to get anywhere. But when the turn has come to shutting down sort of institutions, and the issue is not, you know, did Justin Timberlake rip off part of Janet Jackson's bra, but, like, can companies operate in an independent way, we're in real trouble. Unless somebody decides to say, no, I'm going to defend my company, I'm going to defend this speech. I think that's actually one of the things that I find scariest about this moment is that the decision that the sort of playing defense, the rear guard action, is what's going to carry the day, because it's not clear to me that it is.
I do think that the courts are going to be pretty good on this. And they have,
yes, the courts, which is why you have to fight
tended
instead of
to
settle.
Be. Yeah, the courts have, even Republican appointed judges have tended to be quite good on speech. That's not a blanket. That's a tendency, not a blanket statement. I'm sure you can find exceptions. But in general, the Supreme Court in particular has been quite defensive of a strong and expansive understanding of the First Amendment. I think that ultimately they will be here, as well as the lower courts. And the NewsGuard suit stuff that I talked about earlier was in fact tossed by a judge just this last week because it was so obviously BS.
Yeah. Well, it's one of the legacies of Antonin Scalia, who was a very strong, very, very conservative, very strong defender of expression across a wide range of activities and beliefs. All right. So what do we think? Is it a controversy or a non-controversy that the FCC is targeting Disney and ABC and other outlets that the administration does not seem to care for its DEI activities? Peter?
It's a controversy, though sadly, it's not an unexpected one.
Alyssa?
It's a controversy, and all of this administration's talk about free speech is just one of the great acts of psychological projection I've ever seen in American politics. It's amazing.
It's very clearly a controversy, and I want to end this with a quote from Ari Cohn at FIRE, the Foundation for Individual Rights and Expression, who kind of sums it up perfectly here. Quote, "The threat is, if you say things that I don't like, or that I think will anger the president of the United States who appointed me, then I'm going to exercise whatever rights that I have as FCC chair and wield the power of this agency to hassle you in other ways." End quote. That was to your publication, Peter. That was a quote given to Reason magazine. But it's the crux of this whole thing. It's insane. It's insane that we're even having to argue about this. There is no universe in which the FCC should be able to do this. And this is, we could get into a broader discussion about the role government should be playing in any of this, but it's a real reminder that one of the things that could have been done over the last 4 years was reducing the amount of power that the federal government had to do things like this unilaterally. And sadly, that chance was not taken. Again, argument for another time. Make sure to swing by Bulwark Plus on Friday for our bonus episode about some truly terrible ideas to improve the state of movie theaters. Gotta love them. They're trying the worst things possible. Now on to our
best
main event.
Weed gummies and 5D.
We'll get there. Don't worry. We'll get there. All right. Now on to our main event. A working man, following last year's surprise hit The Beekeeper, star Jason Statham and director David Ayer, reteam for this movie where, and you guys are never going to believe this out there, Jason Statham plays a tough guy who is called upon to do violence against the wicked on behalf of wronged innocents. I know, shocking stuff. It's very out of character for him. The setup is theoretically pretty simple, right? Statham plays Levon Cade, formerly of the British Armed Forces, and currently the foreman at a construction site. When bad guys kidnap his boss's daughter, he promises to get her back by any means necessary. And so he does, yada, yada, yada. All right, this is the barest bones description of what should be happening in this movie. Really, it's all the movie needed. But a working man is weirdly convoluted. This girl is taken by Americans who were working for the Russians. This Russian is himself something of a black sheep in the Russian mob scene. And then also he's working with a black meth dealer who has a motorcycle gang, and they're trying to all sell the girl to a guy who looks weirdly like the magical Uncle Drosselmeyer from the classic ballet, The Nutcracker, like cape and all. Like, I don't know. I don't know if you guys, it jumped out to you guys, because I was like, that's the Nutcracker uncle right there. Anyway, I'm a sucker for this sort of movie. Believe me, I'm a sucker for this sort of movie. So I still give it a grudging pass. Thumbs up for me later on. However, it's useful to compare A Working Man, which I think just barely works, to The Beekeeper, which I think is about as good as a generic high concept Jason Statham action movie can be. All right, so The Beekeeper had four things going for it. Four things. One, It was simple. A woman has her life savings stolen and she kills herself, and Jason Statham works his way up the criminal food chain to punish the guilty. It had great villains. Everybody hates a phone scammer, especially those who prey on the elderly. And everyone hates Gen Z millennial types who are on their phones all the worst. It has solid action with surprising kills, but it wasn't mired in the kind of 87 North style that has predominated in the post John Wick era. It was like kind of old fashioned action in its way. And it made very amusing use of the high concept, right? And lots of bee puns about protecting the hive and so forth. And A Working Man is worse on all fronts. It's just worse on all the fronts. It's way too complicated. Way too complicated. I needed like an org chart to keep track of all the villains. And like a bunch of them kind of looked like each. There were two women in this movie who looked very much like each other. And I couldn't figure out. I had trouble keeping it all straight. The villains are certainly evil. And I want to give special credit to a costume designer, Tiziana Corbersieri. I'm sorry, I'm butchering her name. She did a great job of making sure they stand out in like cartoonish ways. There are these two Russian guys who look kind of like, they're either Russian Laurel and Hardy toward the end of the movie, or Russian Alfred E. Newman and Uncle Fester. I wasn't sure which way to go with it.
But then there's also the bucket hat twins.
Well, there's also the tracksuit twins who are great in their own way. But that's like kind of whatever. They're also very good. But they're all just so generic. They're all just so generic at the end of the day that like I had trouble really caring about watching them get their comeuppance. The action is by far the weakest part of this movie. It is far less stylishly done than The Beekeeper. It's kind of the herky-jerky handheld style that's all stitched together in the editing room. And there's no like real creative kills. Like I want a creative kill or two. That's all I want. And most annoyingly, the screenplay by Ayer and Oscar nominee Sylvester Stallone does nothing with the working man conceit, right? He barely uses any construction gear in his fights. There are no construction puns at all. I want to know about like sturdy foundations and what that means for, you know, beating people up. Whatever. None of that. Not a single
He's
one.
He's got a spine of steel.
Very disappointing. Very disappointing. If you are making a movie about a foreman who is wreaking havoc on bad guys, I want lots of like nail guns being used and like, I don't know, circular saws, but none of that. It's really disappointing, frankly.
Beat somebody with a wrench. That's all I ask of a movie called A Working Man.
Sure. All right. So it's no Beekeeper. Yeah, it's still pretty good, though. Alyssa, what did you make of A Working Man?
What? This movie is not pretty good, Sonny. I'm sorry. I literally leaned over to Peter at one point this afternoon and was like, so did they just buy the leftover sets from Buffy the Vampire Slayer that have been like sitting in cold storage for 20 years and like maybe needed to be dusted off ahead of the like potential sequel that they're making? Like, did they buy the costumes from like Twilight flashbacks to, you know, like the Jazz Age and some period when people like wore petticoats for the hell of it? Like, this movie is stupid and it looks bad.
This was at a moment, by the way, when the characters suddenly appear in front of a moon that is like the most fake moon I have ever seen.
And also the biggest moon I've ever seen in my life.
Yes. Also is the size of something much larger than a moon.
It was like, it was like having the Death Star appear on the horizon.
But not on the horizon. It's like overshadowing them. It's the biggest stupid freaking moon I have ever seen. It's like you bought the moon wall.
Okay. All right, let's move on from the moon. So, the moon was very big.
The moon was very big. Like, I was pretty sure that there were going to be just like somebody in werewolf makeup wandering in and being like, "Oh shit, I'm on the wrong set." Nothing about this movie works from minute to minute, right? Like, we have this subplot that like Levin is in some weird custody dispute with his his father-in-law over his granddaughter. And he only has like $10,000 that he's saved up from working construction and living in his car to pay his divorce lawyers. But also he has like five cars in this movie. He has like, and they're like, you see that F-150 logo on the screen. You see the Ram logo on the screen. You see like multiple sedans. There's like, even before he steals a motorcycle, there's another motorcycle that he appears to own, right? So
Well, of course he doesn't have any money for divorce lawyers. He's buying a ton of cars. He needs his vehicles.
Because he's a working man. He needs different trucks. He needs a cool car.
They love big trucks and they love motorcycles.
Right. I mean, look, I've heard Ruben Gallego, like, all men want is just like a big ass truck in every garage. That's, you know, that's the American dream. But like, either he's really broke or like at least have something about how he's like hiding all his money so he can secretly be a badass, or like either he is an insane secret agent military badass or he's a blue collar hero, right? Like those two things, like a genuinely sort of struggling, scraping by blue collar hero. Like, and like one thing you could do that could be interesting in a movie like this is like, oh, actually he doesn't have a lot of money for like fancy stuff. So again, he has to improvise in this. You guess like, you know, wrenches of death. The Russian villains are like, it's literally like they took all of the stunt doubles from a John Wick movie and were like, would you like to be the like actual actors in a movie? Like, would that be fun for you? They're all awful. I'm sorry, but if someone's like strutting around with like a death's head cane and like some other guy is wearing like Viking horns on a motorcycle helmet, everything about this movie looks like David Ayer lost a bet. That was like, you have to use the contents of this entire backlot in a movie. And if you don't find a way to put everything on the screen, no matter how nonsensical it seems, you have to buy me a Porsche or like a jet or something, right? I mean, this movie just feels like the result of a bad bet. It has nothing to say about sex trafficking. It has nothing to say about rising, you know, industrious Latino family that owns this construction business, which again, could have been sort of a really interesting subplot, right? Like Michael Pena is a really appealing actor. I love seeing him on screen. And the fact that literally he's here to be like, okay, here's my credit card. And then like drink tequila sadly is just, again, like a total, it's an irksome waste of a good actor. And so I found every single minute of this movie basically excruciating, with the exception of like a 45 second fight scene on the construction site
that has
like
nothing to do with the rest of the movie.
Nothing, absolutely nothing.
Doesn't develop anything, doesn't pay off anything.
It sets the stage to show that he's a badass. You need that as it's foreshadowing.
Oh, you're right.
It's foreshadowing.
I didn't know that.
I'm sorry. Some of us don't like literary conceits like foreshadowing in our action movies. Fine.
It's not even foreshadowing. I mean, it's just very annoying. I hated this movie. It's not good. And yet, some people whose taste I sometimes otherwise respect seem to have liked this movie. So maybe I'm missing something. Convince me what I missed. But I honestly thought it was excruciating.
Peter, convince Alyssa she's wrong.
No, I also did not like this movie at all. And I think it's worth comparing it to superior examples of the really good trashy action film, because this is a bad trashy action film. But The Beekeeper was at least a pretty good and maybe even a quite good trashy action film. And one thing that The Beekeeper did was it set the human stakes early on. And I wouldn't say that it's super sophisticated about the way that it does this, but it gives you like a brief emotional connection between the Statham character, the beekeeper, right? And the woman whose money is stolen in the, you know, he's like working, he's doing a beekeeping on her farm, right? So it sets up that emotional connection in like a nice, succinct, straightforward way, in a way that this movie briefly tries to do with a single scene inside Michael Pena's office with his daughter. But like that scene doesn't work and doesn't develop and doesn't pay off at all. So there's no emotional stakes for the people you're supposed to like. But then even more importantly, what The Beekeeper did really well was it didn't just give us villains who you can hate. It gave us a reason, a specific reason to hate them. That movie dwelled on and spent actually quite a few of its minutes walking you through the scam that the bad scammers were running on old people. You actually saw it happen and you saw their elation at it. And you saw that this was not a one-time thing, but something that they were doing to a lot of people. This was a whole big ass scam operation. And so by setting that up at the beginning, you then just hate these. It's not just that they're millennials. It's not just that they're internet scammers. It's that they're these people who are disgusting, like reveling in their own cleverness and the like their ability to take other people's money in a way that makes them specifically hateable. And there is nothing. Okay, if you want to, like, the premise makes these people specifically hateable, but the movie actually doesn't dwell very much on what the bad guys are doing. It doesn't introduce us to any kind of consistent or larger ongoing running scam. Yes, there are hints, there's a suggestion that this happens regularly, although you barely get that until about an hour and 10 minutes into the movie when you find out a little bit more about how this thing is run. There's no sort of upfront investment in these bad guys are bad, not just because they're goofy looking, not just because they're clearly bad guys in movie nomenclature, but because they are doing something that is quite specifically hateable. This movie doesn't do that. And if you think about, like, another film franchise that does a lot of the same work here, the Equalizer films, which I think all of us more or less liked, especially that first one. That movie is, I don't know, I think it's actually a little bit too long, but that movie spends like 45 minutes setting up the relationship between Denzel Washington and the young woman who is taken and abused that sort of sets off the plot, right? Denzel Washington, like that movie is like a half an hour of Denzel Washington going to a diner and reading old books and just having conversations. And so we see the web of relationships that Denzel Washington has to his world and to all of these characters. We see him working in that home. I don't think it's technically called a Home Depot. Maybe it is, but like in that Home Depot-like warehouse, right? That then becomes extremely important in the third act when the whole third act is, I'm going to murder you with tools. And this movie is so bizarre in that it doesn't establish any of those relationships. But to the extent that it has a premise at all, it's a construction guy played by Jason Statham kills a bunch of bad people. And there is a 2-minute sequence at the very beginning of the movie that doesn't pay off at all, in which he hurts some bad people who are not in any way related, to be clear, right, to the main bad guy scheme. Not at all. It's a completely different ethnic group of bad guys. It's some Hispanic gang lords who show up on the construction site to do something.
They're messing with a member of they're interfering with the efficiency of his construction site on a day when they're going to be inspections.
That's well, this right. is and this is I like again. I hate to harp on this because it is kind of it's silly in a way, but like if you're gonna make a movie like this, you have to play up the premise, right? Like there was this movie that came out last year called The Bricklayer. I think it was Aaron Eckhart stars as he's a hitman who was also like really into masonry, like literally like literally like and there's nothing in the movie that like draws those two things together. Like the problem with the movie is again one of the problems with A Working Man, which again I mostly kind of tolerated and enjoyed, was that if you're going to have this like he's a construction guy and he kills bad people, that's a great idea, make those two things work together. And instead it's like he's a construction guy but actually he's just a really good soldier. He's just a soldier. Like, that's what it comes down to. He's just a soldier. And there's a whole... speaking of subplots that really don't go anywhere, I didn't mention this at all. The subplot with David Harbour, where he's his blind friend who got wounded in war. And, like, okay.
He's also a weapons sommelier.
Which is just ripped straight from John Wick 2. Like, that sequence is literally
from John Wick 2, but it's also exactly the... we're going into the underground bunker to get the cool guns scene from Terminator 2. It's just that it shows up at the end of the second act, at the transition from act 2 to act 3. It's like, oh, we need act 3 to be bigger and he needs to be heavily armed. So he's got a guy he can go to.
Yeah. I mean, I found the treatment of military service and veterans in this movie really kind of odd and off-putting. And I was curious if either of you had that reaction too, because, you know, there's this through line like, does Levin have PTSD? You know, what did he do in Iraq, Afghanistan, wherever he was? You know, there's this weird sort of sense of like, there's something important about like the, you know, Anglo-American coalition. There's this weird moment of sort of accord with the guy who runs the motorcycle gang who was also in the military. But it's very cursory and really just ends up sort of boiling down to the idea that like, oh, you know, being in the military is just about like being violent and killing people. And you know, I think you could do something really interesting that would in some ways harken back to Rambo with the question of like, what has American society done with the veterans of the war on terror, right? Like, how have we responded to these folks? How have they been reintegrated into, you know, the economy or not? And the movie's just totally uninterested in that question. But I do think that question of, you know, we had these recent wars that are very uncomfortable to talk about. And we have not fully, you know, sort of come up with a society-wide idea about how we're supposed to think about that service. And I found it sort of offensive the way that the movie gestured at that while having just no interest in engaging with it. And I wonder if there was more of that in the original screenplay.
The screenplay is a mess. The screenplay does not really work at all, which is, you know, that's something else. But it
feel like it's been heavily edited, heavily reworked. This doesn't feel like this is what the film set out to be. Like, it got its title and its premise, or maybe this was pasted on afterwards, but like, it got its title and its premise, and then the movie couldn't figure out how to deliver on that thing. And so we get a very generic action film instead that has none of the kind of intrigue escalation that the Beekeeper had, right? So it's not just that the Beekeeper had all of this sort of establishing the web of relationships, the character's world, like making you care at the beginning. It's also that it had these insane narrative escalations as you went on. And this movie has some narrative escalations, but not any that matter or are interesting at all. It's just like, here's another guy. Here's yet another guy.
It has complications. It doesn't have escalations. And there's a difference there. They're like, the movie just gets weirdly complicated. I found myself on several occasions just being like, okay, who does this person work for now? And like, that is not a thing I should be thinking when I'm watching.
Here's some more Russian psychopaths.
Anyway, yeah.
There's a scene in The Beekeeper in the middle of the movie. That is that when we reviewed that film, we talked about it takes place at a gas station. And there's this like crazy kind of cartoon assassin psychopath who seems almost out of place in the film. And the film is good enough that it sort of manages to work it in. But it's this cartoon scene that's sort of ridiculous and doesn't quite fit in with the rest of the movie. And this film like feels like that, except for that's the whole movie.
Yeah.
So thumbs up or thumbs down on A Working Man. Peter.
Thumbs down.
Alyssa.
Thumbs down, obviously.
I don't think it's obvious at all. I give it a thumbs up. A very begrudging thumbs up. Very begrudging thumbs up. But you two are haters. You're haters. You're probably pro-trafficking. Let's be honest. Come on. That's what this comes down to. All right. That's
slander.
That's it for today's show.
I'm going to send Brendan Carr on you.
That's it for today's show. Many thanks to our producer, Rupert Manderstam, without whom this program would sound much worse. Make sure to swing by Bulwark Plus on Friday for our bonus episode, Tell Your Friends. A strong recommendation from a friend is basically the only way to grow podcast audiences. If you don't grow, we'll die. If you did not love today's episode, please complain to me on Twitter at Sonny Bunch. I'll convince you that this is, in fact, the best show in your podcast feed. See you guys on Friday.